Women made some big gains in the 2018 elections, with a historic number elected to Congress and in state legislatures in many states. But in Wisconsin, the numbers lagged behind the national trend. In a recent piece for WisContext, our next guest digs into some theories about why Wisconsin women didn't have a breakthrough year in politics. Ryan Weichelt is an associate professor of geography at UW-Eau Claire. Ryan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, remind us, take us back to 2018. How big a year was this nationally when it comes to women being elected to public office?
Well, I think we saw across the entire country this sort of, if you want to call it a blue wave, but a sort of wave of Democrats doing quite well. And then out of that, we really see that women had done quite well nationally. If we look at things in 2018, there's about 102 women that were elected to the House of Representatives. 89 of those were Democrats compared to 13 Republicans. And that was 37 more new people elected to the House in 2018 than compared before.
And have we seen that partisan division in the number or percentage of women elected to Congress, Democrat versus Republican?
Yeah, I see. It seems to recently especially have been more skewed towards women as Democrats compared to the Republican Party.
And why is that? Do we have ideas on why more women are running and, I guess, winning as Democrats than as Republicans?
I think if we take 2018, obviously the impact of Donald Trump on the campaign, we see with polling results certainly illustrated that women were turned off by Donald Trump, and specifically women in suburban areas. I think it sort of helped galvanize and help people be interested in running for office, and specifically females running for office more so than males at the Democratic level.
And do we have a sense of, I said, running and winning? Is this a story where it's more women are running or the same amount of women are running, but more of them happen to be winning, or a little of both?
I guess if you take it into, I can speak for Wisconsin purposes, it seems to be more women are running in Wisconsin, but they're certainly not winning.
Yeah, let's take this to the state level and here in Wisconsin, because that was one of the big stories, more women in Congress. As I understand it, more women in state legislatures in many states, including some of our neighbors, not happening here in Wisconsin. Is that right?
Yes, it's certainly true. If we look at the 2019 composition of state legislatures, be it the House or Assembly or Senate or whatever they're called in their particular states, Wisconsin is only at 27.3% compared to Michigan's at 35.8%, Minnesota 31.8%, Iowa 30%, and Illinois at 36.2% female.
So what is it about Wisconsin that might make us different than those other states and have this still lower percentage of women in the legislature?
I certainly think it is a huge attestment to the redistricting process that took place after 2010. The 2010 election is a watershed election for Wisconsin. We saw vast changes at the state level, and as 2012 approached, as the redistricting models were put in place through Act 43, we certainly see that incumbency incumbency advantage. People that have win their seats, it's pretty easy for them to stay. And we see this both for Democrats and Republicans, that those that one in 2010 or 2012 especially, there wasn't much change that took place. The elections at the state level haven't been too exciting since 2012 up to 2018, and I think that plays one important role in this. I think another important role, though, has to relate to how our legislature is comprised. We're considered a professional legislature. That means it's a full-time job all throughout the year. Michigan and Illinois have similar types of legislatures, but that certainly can hold back people's movement into politics, meaning if you're in a particular job, you could take my example as a professor, you know, I got to work all year round. I can't just take time off every few months to go down to Madison to run for legislature. Women tend to be in higher proportions of jobs in the service sector, and that sort of create a barrier for people to participate in politics.
Talking to Ryan Weichelt, associate professor of geography at UW-Eau Claire, talking about a piece he wrote for WisContext. You can see it at wiscontext.org on the number of women in legislatures at the state level and national level here in Wisconsin in particular. Ryan, I want to take each of those points you just made in turn and dig a little more into them. First, that the redistricting and the advantage for incumbents. So that would mean, in effect, that we've taken maybe the gender mix from about 10 years ago, like 8, 9 years ago, and encased it in amber in some ways, right?
Yeah, exactly. If you go back to 2001, 2003-ish, actually the Republicans had more women in the state Senate than the Democrats did. But we saw this sort of erosion take place. And then by 2010, 2012, it certainly switched a lot, where there's a lot more, those women that were in the Assembly or Senate tended to be more Democratic.
Now, we hear about a gender gap in voting. It varies from election to election, candidate to candidate. Have we seen a growing gender gap where women are more prone to vote for Democrats than Republicans, whether those candidates are men or women?
I mean, if we want to take 2016, 2018 election in the state of Wisconsin, and certainly see that, at, as I mentioned earlier, at the suburban level. Looking at the 2016 election, if you kind of look at the election results from 2012 compared to 2016 in the suburban areas around Milwaukee, it was one place that Hillary Clinton actually saw an increase in vote compared to 2012. And a lot of that national polling sort of illustrated that a lot of that was suburban women that were didn't like Donald Trump and some of the things that he had said.
Now, let's turn to that second point you made about the professional legislature. Wisconsin's a full-time legislature, which may make it difficult for some people, as you're saying, depending on their job, to seek office. How do we compare it to our neighbors? How do they do their legislature as far as time commitment and then compensation and staff support?
Yeah, again, Michigan and Illinois have a similar type of professional legislature. But compared to Wisconsin, they get paid a lot more. In Michigan, it's $71,000 plus expenses. Illinois, it's about $67,000 plus a per diem. In Wisconsin, that's only $51,000 in per diem. Now, Iowa and Minnesota do, they call it a hybrid approach. They have different contexts. They don't meet nearly as much, and they only get paid in Iowa $25,000, and then Minnesota, it's about $31,000. But there's a lot more time for them to not be at the state capitol compared to places like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Illinois.
But in Michigan and Illinois, I guess if it's full-time, but they get paid more, it might be a realistic option for that person thinking of running for office, thinking, well, if I win, maybe I can quit my job for whatever the term is, 2 or 4 years.
I potentially certainly fits into that idea.
Has there been talk of changing the idea of a professional legislature here in Wisconsin? I know there's at least one columnist for the Capital Times, Dave Zweifel, who, I'm going to say, for decades has said we should have a part-time legislature in Wisconsin. Is that something anybody's talking about?
I really haven't seen much written on it. I was just sort of, why I came up with this piece was just to kind of add another piece to the discussion of really asking the question, you know, what's happening with our state legislature, and specifically, why are females in the state of Wisconsin not participating at the level compared to others? I'm not saying this is the only cause, but I think it's another piece that I think deserves much more discussion moving forward.
Now, you've made the case, drawing back a little bit, for thinking more about geography when it comes to our politics and elections. Why do you think that's important?
Well, as a geographer, we study places. We're interested in the spatial context of things. And election patterns themselves, having been doing election analysis for a long time, they don't change very often. When they do change, if we can identify where those changes are taking place, we can start bringing much more of that local context, try to understand why those changes are taking place. So, you know, the example of looking at the rural areas of Wisconsin, specifically, if we think about the geography and what's going on, Donald Trump's success in 2016 certainly worked well in different parts of rural Wisconsin, depending on what the issue was. If it was immigration, it certainly played well in the dairy areas. If it was manufacturing, it played well in places like western Wisconsin with frac sand mining. A lot of other studies, like surveys and stuff, don't really get into the meat of the geography, and so to understand the local context is what's key to really understanding politics.
Now, I know the 2018 elections in some ways feel like they were forever ago, but in terms of collecting data, it was just a few months ago. What kind of questions came out of that election that you're hoping to tackle?
Yeah, I'm really interested in, you know, what happened in those rural areas. It seems to be that they're starting to solidify themselves more than they had in the past, meaning solidifying themselves as more Republican. And then specifically when Scott Walker's off the next ballot, what's going to happen in those suburban areas, specifically among suburban women, educated women, as sort of we move forward? Those are some interesting places that I've been sort of watching, as well as the Fox River Valley and the manufacturing sectors. We've seen a little bit of movement in the last few elections in those particular areas.
Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thank you so much.
We've been talking to Ryan Weichelt, Associate Professor of Geography at UW-Eau Claire. He was with us to talk about why fewer women are in Wisconsin state legislature than many other states, in spite of a so-called Year of the Woman in 2018. You can find his piece online at wiscontext.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're taking a look at some of the big news in national politics. The U.S. Senate is getting set to vote on a resolution that would block President Trump's national emergency declaration until he vetoes it. House committees are seeking financial documents from the White House and many individuals after Michael Cohen's testimony. And the Democratic National Committee is deciding how to handle debates in a ever more crowded field of primary candidates. Amanda Turkle is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, last week, a resolution to block that declaration of a national emergency, it passed in the House. Now the Senate has to vote on it. Apparently, they're preparing for that vote, and it looks like there might be enough Republicans joining Democrats to pass this. Who are some of these crossover votes, Amanda?
Sure. Well, so far, Republicans Rand Paul from Kentucky, Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, Tom Tillis from North Carolina, and Susan Collins from Maine are the senators who said they're against it. And it's going to, the resolution disapproving of what Trump wants to do is going to pass the Senate, which is pretty remarkable because the Senate is controlled by Republicans. Rand Paul is opposed to it. He's a libertarian. He says unconstitutional in his opinion. And he says he knows of at least 10 Republican senators who have said they're against it. I don't know if there really will be 10 Republicans crossing over, but it's a pretty strong rebuke of the president in the fact that it's not going to pass a chamber controlled by his own party.
It'll pass both chambers, it looks like, but then the president can veto it, and then there's not a two-thirds majority in either house, right, to override that.
Right, exactly. So ultimately, Trump is going to get his way, but it's going to be embarrassing. Trump is going to use his first veto on this, which is, you know, the people who are the lawyers who are going to be suing Trump over this, saying that this national emergency declaration is unconstitutional, this congressional resolution helps them because they say, look, he's going around Congress. Congress didn't give him the money for this wall. And they said that his national emergency declaration isn't constitutional and they disapprove of it. So this is twice that he's going around Congress. And so they think it will help their case in getting what Trump's doing thrown out.
Now, Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said he didn't like this national emergency idea. He didn't want the president to do this. Could you talk about the position now Mitch McConnell is in trying to work with the president and seeing at least a partial revolt of his own caucus?
Well, Mitch McConnell is doing what he always does, which is ultimately he stands with the president. Even if he doesn't like it, even if privately he disagrees, he is a party guy, and he is interested in making sure that Republicans have power and doing what Trump wants. And so in this case, he did say that he didn't like it, but he's going to, you know, support Trump. And, I mean, you know, there are other Republicans who may vote against this. I mean, there are Republicans like maybe Ted Cruz or Mike Lee who don't like it on constitutional grounds and also say, look, if we're doing this now, a Democratic president could do it on climate change or something like that. There are Republicans who are locked in tough reelection races in more purple states, people like Cory Gardner in Colorado. And then there are people who don't like the fact that Trump is going to use money meant for the military to build this wall when maybe it could be better used for other things.
Do we know when this vote is actually supposed to happen?
Not yet. It's expected to be next week sometime, but there's still no date.
I want to move on to some other big news now. We had, of course, Michael Cohen, former Trump attorney, testifying before a House committee. He testified before a few committees, one of them publicly. Now some Democratic-led committees are asking for documents from the White House and from Trump associates. What kind of things are they looking for?
Sure. This is Trump's nightmare, and this is sort of what he knew was coming if Democrats took control of the House. And so the House Judiciary Committee has sent out more than 80 letters asking for documents relating to Trump. And, you know, these are going out to people like Jared Kushner, for example, his son-in-law, and people who have worked with Trump for years, Alan Weisselberg and his business partners. And so they are looking for anything about whether Trump has engaged in obstruction of justice, corruption, abuse of power. These letters have gone out to the NRA. And what it makes clear is that, you know, Democrats are not just looking at one thing with Trump. They are casting as wide a net as possible. And they are, you know, just hoping to get documents to see what he has done on basically everything.
And what's been the response from the president and his spokespeople?
Well, Trump's response is basically what you expect. You know, this is a witch hunt. Democrats are abusing their power. The White House is saying that they will cooperate when, you know, they've been preparing for this for quite a while. They will cooperate when they think it's appropriate, but they're obviously going to try to limit the scope of the investigations. They'll claim executive privilege when they feel like they need to preserve confidentiality. And they will obviously challenge some of what Democrats are doing. But they said they would like to be cooperative as possible. You know, we will see how cooperative or what their definition of cooperative really is.
Talking to Amanda Turkle from The Huffington Post, looking at some of the top news in national politics. On a related note, Amanda, speaking of requesting documents, a House committee also looking for, this is the House Oversight Committee now, looking for documents related to Jared Kushner's security clearance. Now, talk about some of the reporting that led us up to this point.
Sure. Well, I mean, this is already an example of where the White House is not being cooperative. So Jared Kushner, he did not get the top security clearance that basically the White House requested for him because, and we don't know why exactly, but it seemed to be, there seemed to be indications that it was because of his and his family's business dealings, their real estate deals, especially when it came to deals with foreign countries. He could be compromised somehow. We don't really know. And that's what Democrats want to find out. And so Trump has claimed, and Jared Kushner did eventually get a security clearance. Trump has said that he didn't intervene, but there's been new reporting showing that he actually did intervene. And he did overrule, for example, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly and say that he wanted Kushner to get a security clearance, even though the professionals didn't recommend it. And so now Democrats want the documents about his security clearance. And the White House is saying that they're not going to turn them over.
What are members of the House Oversight Committee saying they want to review and why they want to review it?
Well, I think they want to know why this top advisor, senior advisor in the White House, who's honestly in some ways functioning as Trump's chief of staff, you know, why he might be compromised. Why can't this guy get a security clearance? Is there something they should know that's in the public interest? That's sort of what they're looking for.
And then, Amanda, you've written about this. So we have this presidential election coming up. I don't know if people are aware of that in 2020. And a lot of Democratic candidates, and we're starting to see signs of how the Democratic National Committee will handle debates with this growing pool of candidates. What kind of rules are we hearing about now?
So the first two debates, they're going to be in June and July. As you know, the field is already massive. At most, the Democrats are going to allow 20 people to participate. I don't know if there are going to be 20 candidates who qualify, but there could be 20 candidates. And the debates could be spread out over two nights, consecutive nights. And so Democrats have said that in order to qualify, you have to reach 1% support in at least three separate polls. Or, and this is new, a candidate has to raise money from at least 65,000 unique donors and a minimum of 200 unique donors per state in at least 20 states. So basically, they're trying to do the standard thing of, you know, are you getting high polling numbers? You can be in. But they also want to allow for the fact that maybe someone isn't registering in polls, but they're getting a groundswell of grassroots support through fundraising. They get to be in the debate, too. I don't know if there is going to be someone who maybe reaches number two, the fundraising thing, and not the polling thing. But they are doing that in big part because they got so much criticism in 2016 that they didn't pay enough attention to Bernie Sanders.
When Republicans had a lot of candidates last year, we had what people called kind of the main debate and the JV debate, where the lower polling candidates met on a separate stage, a separate event that of course, then got less attention. It looks like Democrats aren't going to take that approach. They'll just kind of mix and match.
Right, right. It's going to be random. The Republicans got a ton of criticism from that, and it was sort of considered to be a disaster. And so this time it's going to be random. I don't know exactly how they're going to randomize it, but, you know, so you could have a big mix of the front runners and lesser known candidates on the stage over two nights if the networks decide to do that.
And one more bit of information, it looks like the DNC will not have a debate hosted by Fox News. This after a New Yorker report by Jane Mayer tracking the coordination, which she found to be overlap between the Trump White House, Fox News channel, and the Trump campaign. What do you make of that decision by the Democrats to say, okay, no Fox for the debates?
I think it makes a lot of sense. I mean, they were getting, you know, there were a lot of Democrats who really don't want Fox News to have a debate. You know, they're considered, based on that New Yorker article, a propaganda outlet for Trump and for Republicans, but mostly Trump, honestly. And so the thinking goes, why should they get a debate for the Democratic primary? You know, there were other Democrats who said, like, we need to reach, they're a network with a huge audience. We need to reach those voters, too. They should get to do one. But ultimately, the DNC decided that, based on everything they read from that New Yorker piece and what they know about Fox, they don't get to do one.
Finally, Amanda, on a non-political note, you had tweeted about this sad news. Luke Perry, Beverly Hills 90210 star, he was in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the movie. He's been in Riverdale most recently. Passed away this week at age 52. This was a part of your growing up TV habit, it sounds like.
He was. I mean, obviously... You know, obviously we were all very sad in my office, and I think online everyone was mourning Luke Perry. I mean, I remember him when I was a kid watching 90210, but more recently I'm a fan of Riverdale on Netflix, and so I think he's been great as the dad, as Archie's dad in, on Riverdale. So, you know, it was very, very sad news.
A sad, sad moment, of course, for his family and friends and for TV viewers around the world. Amanda, thanks as always for joining us.
Great, thank you.
That's Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post, with us for a weekly look at the top news in national politics.